And welcome to episode 8 of season 3 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Sunday 16th of May, and in this special episode you'll hear some exclusive interviews recorded at the Ubuntu Developer Summit in Brussels. I'm Laura, and with me this evening is Tony. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Laura. It's just the two of us this evening.
It is.
Why is that?
Because Alan and Davey went to UDS.
Ah, yes. We sent them off to the Ubuntu Developers Summit, which is where the plans for Maverick Meerkat are being fleshed out, or were fleshed out, and discussed. Alan and Dave were our roaming reporters there, and they got loads of interviews from people who they nabbed in the bar afterwards, I think, on the Friday, talking to them around the hotel as the week wrapped up.
And it didn't seem worth Simon making the journey just to do an intro.
No, I thought we'd spare him the drive in the rain and just say a quick hello and then get on with the content.
In this episode, we'll bring you three interviews. First, it's Robbie Williamson, who was the platform lead for Ubuntu 10.04. He was responsible for making sure it got out the door in good shape. Then we'll hear from Keith Cook from the security team, followed by Rick Spencer, who's the desktop team lead, and he'll talk about replacing the FSpot Photo Manager with Shotwell and the Quickly Application Development Helper.
With us today, we've got Robbie Williamson. He's from Foundations, or not?
Yeah, so it's kind of complicated. So I guess when I first joined the company, Canonical, I was managing the Foundations team for Ubuntu, which is the core OS plumbing layer, boot installer, package management toolchain and such. That was back in October of 2008. Prior to that, I was at the Linux Technology Center for IBM for many years. And so I came in about a week before Intrepid. It was insane. I don't know if you remember that release. There was like a bunch of crazy kernel respins late at night. We didn't know what we were doing. We were flying off the handle. It was crazy. I was like, this is my first job. I don't know if I want to work here. You know, I was up till 4 a.m. It was nuts. I didn't know what I was doing. I was just testing ISOs. And, you know, subsequent releases, John T. Carmack and such, I was just running the Foundations team. So then shortly after, I guess, Carmack release, Matt Zimmerman was going to do an internal company rotation. Mark wanted his senior folks to be able to know more about the business. He had done it with his Launchpad lead, Kiko, and now it was Matt's turn. And so someone had to backfill. And just because I guess maybe the position I was in with Foundations, having to touch, you know, server, desktop, and such. Plus, they don't really need me in Foundations. It's like the rock stars, like Colin Watson, Michael Volt, you know. So anyway, I'm useless there. So I said, sure, you know, I'll cover. And Lucid became mine roughly short after last UDS in December.
How did that release go? I mean, it was obviously we had Lucid issues right up at the very end.
Right.
But on the whole, how did the release go?
It was good. I mean, I think a lot of it, to be honest, was because of the great work around the work items that we put in. That was kind of spearheaded by Rick Spencer on the desktop team, and Pity created that great tool. So we actually knew what work we had to do. It wasn't just like sticking your finger out in the wind saying, I may be done in a month, you know.
So is that the famous burn down charts?
Yes.
Everyone loves the burn down charts.
I told Rick if I didn't have the burn down charts, I would have not. It would have been very hard to just come in, jump in on that, and run with it. I mean, there was some other stuff. We were starting to work with Google a little bit on Chrome OS. It was hush-hush at first, and we were allowed to talk about it, and then I was dealing with that and some other stuff internally. And then I had my son, so I had my second son in December. So it was all at once, you know. but overall, yeah, the work items saved me because I could get a snapshot of what was going on, see problems and such.
So what was the actual job title you took on for that six-month rotation?
I wouldn't say, I guess it was acting CTO, but not, or just platform lead, right? So just getting Lucid out the door was my job. And by that, I mean, you know, the manager's job that I managed. So it was awkward, but we made it work. But yeah, so I was responsible for getting out the door, making the tough decisions on things that, well, there was disagreements and someone needed to make a call. I was like, yeah, just go do it that way. I also played a role, I guess, earlier on in making the whole LTS 2 beta pull from testing kind of plan. That was kind of my idea as well, just because I wanted to actually make something, you know, everyone assumed like an LTS was like a rail or a SLES, but really up until then they hadn't done too much different. And so I said, look, let's make it really stable. You know, let's focus on that, you know, less features, more quality. You know, we can have like pretty desktop-y features. But if you really look at Lucid, there wasn't a lot of technical stuff. I mean, besides the boot, which is huge, that was just us finishing something we started. But other than that, we didn't really cram a lot of technical things in.
Did that make much difference, the change in the way you did the release?
I think that the developer membership board, or maybe the tech board, someone's ran like a survey and got the inputs. It was harder for some areas. I think overall, syncing from testing and having the two beta cycles was good. We wouldn't really do it every release because it slows certain things down. Testing, obviously, and Debian testing doesn't get as much, you know, crackful stuff that we like to pull in and is unstable. I think overall it was good for the LTS, but it's not something we want to do every release.
Okay, if you had a chance to redo that stint, what would you do differently?
What would I do differently? I don't even... Not have my son at that time? I mean, I really don't, you know, if I could reschedule that. Honestly, I don't have any regrets, okay, to be honest with you.
So now we've got past Lucid, we can put that behind us in terms of getting the release out the door, and we're at UDS. You're clearly going to be busy working on new stuff for Maverick. Right. What kind of stuff are we looking for in Maverick?
I think it was summarized today. There's going to be some work on touch, obviously. It's gotten a real big buzz. I mean, obviously with the iPad and everything, I don't think we're going to be anything near that for 10.10, but there is going to be some work around Ubuntu and touch and what we can do there. In Lucid, we actually enabled, like late last minute, we enabled a bunch of touch drivers. Mark had said, look, can we do this so we can have people playing with it by 10.10? He said, well, we looked at it and said, sure, it's just kernel drivers. So we did it with a little bit of testing and had the community support. Software Center is going to be doing in-app payments, or at least payments processing. I don't know about in-app payments. I know that's a big deal. I think we're focusing on other people to be able to sell software, not just like a Canonical thing, right? I think that's the first thing. Like, I think Rick said, look, you will be able to sell one thing in the Software Center. We don't know, but that's a big deal for us. I think Ubuntu One is going to be adding some more services. That's been pretty cool. I was in a session where we were talking about streaming music to your phone that you've purchased on Ubuntu One. I thought that was pretty slick. Server, obviously, it's cloud. More of that. There was a cool session on ARM servers. I don't think we're there yet, but I think that's a big, big deal that we're going to look at going forward.
So something you confirmed today was that we're targeting for the 10.10.10, so 10th of the 10th, 2010.
Right.
Does that raise any concerns for you?
Initially, when I was first asked about it, it was months ago, Mark sent an email, it was like titled Unusual Request, and I saw 10.10.10. I was like, he's crazy. There's no way. We lose 3 weeks, we're not doing that. And then it's like, end of discussion. And then Mark's very persistent. So he slowly started circling, talking to developers, but we all held ranks. They all said, oh, you gotta talk to Robbie. I said, oh man, 10.10.10, we lose. I said, let me just look at it. I said, I'll do my due diligence to look at it. I looked at it and I said, I just don't think we can do it. I said, well, why don't we do like 10 a.m., 10 minutes and 10 seconds or something like that, you know? And he was like, no, it's a once in a lifetime marketing opportunity. I said, okay. I said, well, let me see if there's another, you know, some other, let me look at the schedule deeply. So I started looking at it. It was a couple nights ago, actually. And I started thinking about how we always feel rushed in the 04 release and how there's always this like dip around December timeframe when people go on holiday and such all over the world. It's not like, I mean, people go through holiday throughout the year, but it's just a big dip. And so I said, well, if I really be honest about it, maybe we can get close to it. And started looking at it, and it just happened to line up that it was October 14th was something that would really do it. I think from here on out, we'll release in the middle of October and the end of April to keep that. And so it'll be in the month, so the cadence is there, but it was a focus on development and bug fixing. There was some concern that maybe we should move the April one away from the end of the month because it's only a matter of time before there's that, you know, whatever 05 release, you know, 12.05 or something like that. To be honest, I don't think so. I mean, we've gotten it down to almost a science as far as running these releases. I mean, we were able to respin at the last minute still, and we got it out the door.
So something the project's been working on for quite a while is to try and, as best possible, unify a release for other projects. Now, we're in a similar time to the GNOME project, aren't we? How does that interfere with that?
Yeah, that was a concern. I mean, I gave it a little thought, but to be honest, their schedule kind of slides. I mean, recently, and I've heard rumors that it may not be out there. So I said, look, sometimes I've done previous schedules and I've looked for theirs and it's not up yet. And I was like, look, I got to get this out. So I said, look, we just have to lead the way and just throw it out there. And if there's problems, there's problems, and we'll deal with it. I mean, there was, you know, release coordination was I guess, the meme we were trying to push around Debian. People thought it was like we meant, you know, release coordinating the actual date. It was more of collaborating around key components of the release, which we did, actually. Debian and Ubuntu are sharing some major things like the tool change, Java, and a couple other key components so that, you know, if there's a bug in one, the other benefits and so forth.
Does it make a difference that it's the one after LTS? Is it considered a kind of a bit of a playground? Can we use that? I realize it's still
right,
a release.
Right. No,
it's still
no, important to use it. The Cowboy release, right?
Maverick. Yeah.
I think it used to be that way, but, you know, there's that whole talk about crossing the chasm, right? And that now we're starting to get mainstream users who, I mean, are going to be less tolerant no matter what. They're going to expect a little better quality. Now, it is an LTS release, and if you're using LTS, I think by default it won't trigger upgrades to the next LTS. So we have that going for us. But I think we can't be as I guess, careless in our quality. You know, it's not saying we have to sacrifice features, but it has to be more rigid. You know, think it through and be a little more disciplined when it comes to scoping out what we're going to do. And like again, I said, those work item trackers help a ton. I mean, the developers were a little resistant at the beginning because it just seemed like more work. But then they were like, this is great. I love it. I can see what I'm doing. I can see where I'm trending out so I can cut stuff back. Before, it was just like we were driving blind. I mean, it was literally, there were some times I was like, well, you told me that was ready. And they're like, oh, well, I didn't, you know, we were cutting things at the last minute. It was frustrating for everybody, so.
Does your team have much interaction with the community? I mean, obviously, a large proportion of your team is Canonical people. Is there much interaction with the community? And if there is there anything extra the community can be doing to help your team?
My team being Foundations, or? We have a little. To be honest, it's just kind of the boring stuff, right? I mean, you know, I call it the non-sexy bits, you know, the stuff you don't know about until it breaks and everyone knows. Software Center, I was talking to Michael Vogt. I know that that's picked up some community involvement just because it's kind of getting some coolness. But it's still, I think, more front-end work. He does the back-end. Boot plumbing, not really. I mean, we have some community members who are just rigid and help us out. Release management even is something that my team owns as well. So you have your Scott Kittermans of Kubuntu coming to regular meetings and so forth, helping with that. Super Mario Limoncelli, he does a lot as far. I mean, and yeah, he works for Dell, but trust me, that's not the reason why he does so much that he does. That just has to be a coincidence. So, I mean, if you're interested in those bits, you know, boot, packaging, repository, you know, the archive, stuff like that, sure, ring us up.
Where can they find out more information? What would it be, through Motu or kernel team for testing, that kind of stuff, QA team?
You mean find out more about what we do, or?
Well, find out more about how they can contribute and help, because we find a lot of people don't know what they can do that can help.
I think the first way is testing. It's really great, a way to get involved. Using it, reporting bugs, following through. Sometimes we have call for tests, and that's really useful for us. Yeah, I mean, any way you want to get involved. It doesn't even have to be technical, right? If you just want to start just being a fan of Ubuntu and explaining to people what it is, I mean, we gain a lot. We don't have a real marketing. So Canonical has marketing, but they don't market Ubuntu at all. And that's really, we don't want to do that. People ask, well, you know, why don't we have commercials and such? We have the best of all. We have users who believe in it. That's way more powerful than some cheesy commercial. You know, maybe we get to the point where we need that or can do that, but until then, I'd rather have, you know, dedicated users who love it than somebody being paid to sell it, you know.
So with us today, we've got Kez Cook, and he's from the security team, and we're hoping you can tell us a bit more about what you do. So what does the security team do?
Well, I'd say the main thing that the security team focuses on is providing Ubuntu and all the stable releases that we have with security updates, making sure everyone's machine is up to date and secure and safe to use. And on top of that, we develop proactive security measures so that new issues that come up that people might be vulnerable to, they aren't as exploitable, so it's not as unsafe as they might have been.
Okay, so how do you actually become aware of potential security issues?
There's pretty large community of security researchers in the world, both open source, closed source, from all sorts of different companies and backgrounds who are actually looking for them. You know, they're auditing software, they're trying to break into stuff, they're trying to find those things. And then that stuff gets published, and there's a list of CVEs, which is a unique identifier for individual problems, and we go through a huge list of them and, you know, stay on top of it, and that's where the problems come from generally.
So as a security contact for the distribution, do you actually become aware of these before they're actually disclosed publicly? And how does that actual disclosure process work?
Many of them are what's called embargoed, which is that just the people who are usually, you know, upstream for the software or in distributions, if usually for more severe problems, they notify everyone that is going to be affected for the distribution, the upstream, and everyone involved in making it and building it. And, you know, everyone figures out the problems that they need to solve, and then everyone works together to publish it, so that you can, everyone at the same time releases, and then the issue becomes public, and then there's a very small window of potential attack. The way of looking at it reduces the exposure window that people have in that situation.
So there is collaboration. It's not a case that, you know, we're trying to get a patch out before Fedora or before Windows or OS 10. Is there cross collaboration between open source and proprietary vendors as well?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of collaboration because it's such a fundamental part of the whole ecosystem, if you will, is just making sure everybody's safe at the same time. No one's really trying to outdo anyone else on those types of issues. So it's a great way to collaborate with everybody.
Okay, so that's largely quite reactive stuff to issues you've encountered. I understand that your team's working on some proactive things to make things more secure for the future. What are some of the tools you're doing with that?
A lot of it. So from the beginning, we started with Debian and moved forward from there historically. And there had been a lot of proactive work done to harden the tool chain and do a bunch of other things to keep programs from misbehaving when they were attacked to begin with. Ubuntu has been playing a lot of catch-up, trying to fill in those gaps and involve a lot of those features in the tool chain and everything else that we build into Ubuntu. And Lucid is really awesome in the fact that I feel like we're there, we're caught up, and we're as safe, if not safer, than any other Linux distribution, finally. And that's pretty exciting for me, and I feel like we're in a good position to start trailblazing on more proactive stuff.
What kind of challenges did you have through the Lucid cycle? Because now we've released Lucid, and it's an LTS release. Are there any particular challenges you recall from that cycle?
Nothing hugely jumps out at me, but you know, we spent a lot of time trying to focus on reducing the number of libraries, for example, that do the same thing, but we have multiple versions. So if there's something broken in one, it's going to be broken in all of them. So that's a lot more work to fix each library. So trying to get rid of that duplication and trying to focus on the stability and making sure that, you know, we didn't have any known crash bugs and, you know, other things and features that we were working on.
Okay, so the core of the security team is actually employed by Canonical.
Right.
Yeah. Do you actually have a community following, and are there any plans to try and do what can they do?
We've definitely got on Freenode we have Ubuntu-hardened is our thing. If you go to Ubuntu-security, you're automatically forwarded to that channel. But we've got a lot of people hanging out in there talking about various things, and we have people, you know, sending in patches and trying to fix things and test issues and you know, keep things safe, you know, helping out with everything else that's going on. And we'd like to see more people doing that, and we're trying to improve documentation and make it easier to do testing, because, you know, most people run what's current for them in Ubuntu. You know, people are going to say, oh, hey, Lucid, I'll run that. But, you know, the core security team still has to worry about Hardy and things in between, and even on server, we're still supporting Dapper on servers for a little bit more. So when someone's fixing a security issue and it's in Dapper, and they go, well, how do I test this? I don't have this easily available to me. You know, what do you mean I need to start up a whole virtual machine with the entire, you know, archive available to install software? You know, sometimes that's pretty daunting to get started on. You know, since we do it, you know, all day every day, we've got all these tools set up, you know, we've gone through that, but for one person wanting to fix one thing, it's a lot of work to do that initial setup to get a VM working. So we're going to try and reduce that barrier to entry and make it much easier for people to get involved in that testing.
So do you have a wiki page or set of pages with documentation that help people get started, or is that so far been really quite internal to your team?
No, we've got a lot of wiki pages on the wiki.ubuntu.com/security team. There's quite a bit there. What we identified during UDS this week was that we don't talk a lot about how to get that testing set up going. But, you know, we talk about all our procedures, and we talk about our roadmap, and we talk about all of the proactive features and the processes, you know, a lot of different things that we do and how to get involved and how to triage bugs, how to open bugs, how to, you know, do all these things. But we realized that we were missing this one piece that might be more of a problem for people to get involved more easily. So we're going to try and fix that in the coming weeks and get it better documented, get people involved.
You mentioned sessions here at UDS. Obviously, we're here planning the next release of Ubuntu. Are there any particular sessions that have stood out? Or is there anything particularly important to you to do here at UDS for Maverick?
For me personally, the one thing I'm excited about is a bit of kernel hardening that I'm looking forward to doing. Is now that I feel like we're caught up in a lot of areas, I've been looking around at other distributions whose primary purpose for existing is really, really tightened down security. And I want to try and see if some of their approaches to things and the kernel will work in a general case. And I believe they will, and I showed the kernel team what those things looked like, and they did not freak out, and I think it will be good to add those new features, and I'm excited to work on them, so it'll be good.
Do you have any kind of battle in any way with other developers when you're trying to harden things down and they want, you know, does that hardening cause issues with making programs functional for users, and do you have a battle trying to get your way?
Well, I mean, that's traditionally the hard part about security, is to get something secure without getting in the way of the user. You know, if people see security, you know, if they see something blocking them, it hasn't worked. You know, we failed at providing a good, clean, you know, user-friendly solution that was going to be good. So sometimes you have to figure out what the best approach is for dealing with that. And with the much more strict distros that have these changes, a lot of them are not really good for a general case. But sometimes you can add the feature but not enable it by default, so that, you know, usually this applies more to servers, but, you know, if you have a server admin who's really interested in some specific feature that works for his environment, Ubuntu has the feature and he can turn it on, and they're happy about that. With other stuff where I try to fight for things on by default, I will end up sometimes butting heads with people where we differ in opinion on, you know, how many people will be affected by this, who will have to change, you know, what they're doing, and things along those lines. But I mean, it all boils down to a matter of opinion in those corner cases, and trying to figure out how to make it, you know, as accessible as possible tends to be, you know, it's an interesting, it's not a battle, you know, it's like these are my colleagues, I respect their opinions, and it's fun to try and work it out.
One of the sessions, within one of the sessions, I remember seeing something about changing UMask. Can you explain a little bit about what that is and why that needs to be changed, or might need to be changed?
Oh, sure. It's a little strange, but the UMask is what's the default setting for permissions on files when they're first created. Right now, what we inherit from Debian is what's called 0.2.2, which means that everybody who is not your user basically that's it. Like those, no one else can write to your files. That's good. And then with 2.2, other people can't write to the files that you've created for your group. That's what the second 2 is. The idea being that if you have open access, you can see other people's files and you can share data and you can do these other things, but you can't actually modify someone else's files. But the problem has been that by default, Ubuntu has each user has a group that is named the same as their user. So everyone has their own group. So it doesn't make sense to block this group write, because by default, your group is also unique to your user ID, so it doesn't. There's no difference in getting rid of that second two. So the proposal was to have 002, which means that by default you could write to group-owned files. And what this does is in situations where you're sharing trees of files where you do have a supplemental group that's been set on those files, it's much more easy to, you know, upload a Git tree without doing anything special. You know, you can if you can write to that group, then when you create new files in the Git tree, they're the correct permission and everyone can see them and everything's fine. And this has appeared to be a well understood problem, and everyone walked into the session expecting a bit of a battle, and everyone sat down and said, okay, 002? Oh yeah, that sounds good. Let's sort out how we can make sure we didn't break anything, you know, or make anything unsafe for, you know, large, you know, installs with lots and lots of users who all share the same group. We don't want 002. And as it turns out, someone else has already thought of this. It's already in PAM. We just need to turn it on the correct way. So it was completely uneventful. Everything was great, and there's already an implementation. So done.
So where can people find out more if they do want to get involved in security team or find out more about what you guys do? Where can they find out more?
I'd say probably the wiki page is the best place, wiki.ubuntu.com/security team. And from there, there's a getting involved link, and there's information about what we do and the different areas that people might be interested in. And that's basically it.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thanks for your time.
Cool. Thanks.
So I'm here with Rick Spencer, who works on the desktop team. Your desktop team lead, is that right?
Yeah, it's the title's engineering manager, but the lead is a good description. Yeah.
And what are the highlights from this UDS?
So this was a really creative UDS. We had people from a lot of new parts of the community. We had somebody from upstream Chromium here. We had the new Debian project lead here. It was just, you know, That was a big highlight, just like a lot of new ideas getting injected into the process. I'm really excited about some of our decisions, too, that we took. We took a really exciting decision to default to Chromium, if we can at all swing it, just on UNE. And we took a decision to switch to Shotwell for image management. And I'll be talking to the guys from Yorba next week. We set up something, we can, you know, chat about it, but they seem pretty excited about it from their response to some of the bugs.
Some of those decisions that get made often they just appear in the distro and people out in the wider community kind of see these changes and they don't realize kind of the thought process that goes on. Can you explain a little bit about how you come to these decisions? What process do you go through?
Sure. Well, this is actually something that we do quite transparently, but just maybe not everyone's hooked in and doesn't see what we're doing. So the first thing that we do is we do something that we call logging blueprints. And a blueprint is essentially a web page on Launchpad that states an intention. And then anyone can edit that page and they can say what they think about that intention. So we had one called Simpler Image Editing in Ubuntu. And we listed different image editing tools, different things that we could do up there. And then there was a little bit of discussion on that page. Then we have a session at UDS. And a session at UDS, anybody can come to. It's an open door session. Anyone can come and talk and contribute. And we hash out a decision there. Now, if you can't come to UDS, well, people also get an audio stream. They can listen and they can communicate back on IRC. So it's very much an open discussion. And then we take a decision as a team, as a group. Sometimes those decisions are easy to take. Sometimes they're controversial and a little bit less so. But we take a decision and then we document it again back in the blueprint. And then we break down the blueprint into like what we call work items, figure out what we need to do to make it happen. And then you start to see as the work items get done, you start to see the effects in the distro.
And in terms of replacing applications, so you mentioned that FSpot will be replaced by Shotwell and whatever browser is on UNE, Firefox, I guess, gets replaced by Chromium. How do you manage that process of converting people over? Do you take account of the fact that they might have data in those old applications? How is that going to work, or is that not yet planned out?
Well, it's not specifically planned out, but we do have principles about that. So if you have, first of all, if you're upgrading, we don't typically remove your old application if you've been using it. So we can usually see if it's configured. If there's no data and hasn't been configured, sometimes we'll just replace it with the new one because you're not using it. There's nothing lost there. Sometimes we decide that we better leave the old one in place, but we'll put the other one next to it, let you get used to it a little, and then maybe in a later release. Often we do an in-place replacement. What we're probably going to do with Shotwell, for instance, is if we can, we'll run upgrade scripts that then take all your data that you have in FSpot, make it show up in Shotwell, and you'll have a seamless experience in the Shotwell if we can pull that off.
FSpot has been around for quite a while, and obviously there's a bit of controversy about it being a mono application, and Shotwell doesn't have that baggage. Does that factor into the decision-making process, or is it totally a technical decision, or is it a space issue, or how do you come to those kind of decisions?
It's very multifaceted. So in terms of FSpot being mono, that doesn't really enter into it. I don't really buy into the mono is evil and you should be scared of mono line of thought. I don't know how you feel about it, but it doesn't really, that aspect of it doesn't concern me. We think about the users and what's the best experience. So our goal is always to ship Ubuntu with the best that's currently available for users in free and open source software. And at the moment, we, as a community, after discussion, feel that Shotwell is a better option for users.
So currently in the LTS release, we're still using FSpot, and that's still going to be maintained. But for all new installs onwards, it's going to be Shotwell.
Yeah, that's correct. But we'll continue to deliver FSpot. And if you prefer FSpot, that's still an option that we will totally, you know, support. And, you know, if that's your image library client of choice, we really want you to use it, and we want you to have a great experience on Ubuntu with it.
And Robbie Williamson's been talking about changes to the schedule, what with the 10.10.10 and maybe shortening the development cycle. Is that going to have a deep impact on your work, or is that less of a problem than it might seem?
Well, I actually think it's kind of a neat idea, and I'd like to see us do it. I think it would be really fun. I think maybe when I started as the engineering manager about, say, a year and a half ago, I started with Jaunty was my first release. I think it would have been a much more threatening kind of change for us because our planning process was not very granular, and so it was very hard for us to predict what we actually end up going to deliver. But over the last few releases, we've started those work item system. We've started to use burn down charts and other scheduling systems, and now we have a lot of data about how much work we as a community and we as a team can get done. So now I'm kind of like, you know, it's just another schedule, so we'll just conform to that schedule. Yes, we'll get less done in this release by a small fraction, but that means we'll get more done in the next release by a small fraction. So I think it's all going to balance out. And I'm a big fan of Douglas Adams. I'm 42 years old this year. I really hope we do it.
That's convenient. One of the other things that people may have seen you famous for or blogging about is Qwikly. Can you tell us a little bit about Qwikly, what it does, what it gives us, and how people might be interested in using it?
Sure. Yeah, Qwikly is a project that I started with Didier Roche, who's also on the desktop team now, but he was working in the community at the time. And this is, the users of Qwikly are application developers. So if you want to write a program that runs on Ubuntu, you might want to be a Qwikly user. And what Qwikly does is creates an application, it starts an application for you. So it kind of gets a starter application for you going. And
kind of like a development framework.
Well, there's that aspect of the development frameworks are already there, but we bring it all together. So if you say Qwikly create Ubuntu project Popey's app, it'll create an application called Popey's app. And then you'll use Python and the Python library and all the open source awesome stuff that runs great on Ubuntu. You'll write your killer app. But then the next step is maybe you want to put it in PPA. Maybe you want to release it in some other way. You want to package it, for instance. That can be pretty hard to do, except with Qwikly, we set it up so it's already integrated with Launchpad, so it's very easy to package it. It's, you know, you can say Qwikly share, literally type two words in the terminal, and it'll upload it to your PPA for you. So it's that integration with the developer tools, landing it on the desktop later. That's the heart and soul of Qwikly.
And you've made some, what I've seen called opinionated choices about the fact that it uses BZR, uses Launchpad, it's Python, it's GTK, it uses Glade. These kind of, you know, tools and choices that you've made. Do you see it ever expanding into other languages and other other tool chains?
Right. So yes. So those opinionated choices are very opinionated, and we're very firm about them. But they're limited to the Ubuntu application template. And Qwikly itself just runs commands. So we are hopeful that, you know, other people will make other templates that are maybe for different tool chains. So if you want to make it easy for people to, say, make a general purpose GNOME app, and you think they should be using C for that, or, you know, whatever other choices, we hope that you are inspired to write a Qwikly template for that, and then people can use that to more easily contribute to GNOME. You know, you'd probably be using Git, probably using freedesktop.org, you know. So it's meant to have that kind of flexibility. We do actually have three templates, but since we wrote them, they're all Ubuntu specific, because that's what we know and love. So there's also there's a Ubuntu application template, which is for making a program on Ubuntu that's, you know, just a general kind of windowed application. But we also have a command line template in case you want to make a command line application. And there's a game template in case you want to make a Pi game. You can get started with those.
And once someone's created their application, they can put it in a PPA. I understand there's a blueprint for the next release, which looks at trying to get those things more easily deployable or easy for people to get those into the Ubuntu desktop. Yeah. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Sure. Well, this is something we're really excited about. So currently, if you get a release of Ubuntu, you have to wait essentially 6 months before you can get new software on it, unless you go and add in PPA. And these are very technical things. They're also not necessarily vetted. They can do funny things to your system, and that's sometimes what you want. So we love PPAs because you can go, like, I want to, if you're like a highly technical user and you want to try the latest and greatest Xorg X server, you can go install that in a PPA. But if you just want to play a game, that doesn't really change your system. Like, adding a PPA is, it's hard to find it. You know, you'll never discover the game, and it's too technical to install it. So we're very excited. In Maverick, we're going to make it possible so that the Software Center will light up new applications that are developed after it releases. So after you update to Maverick, if a month later you write a application or a game or something that you want to get to end users, you can make that show up into the Software Center, even though it wasn't ready when Maverick shipped.
And does that go through a review process? Are we talking like Apple Store kind of thing?
Well, yes and no. It will be vetted, but it's going to be vetted by the community. So this is orthogonal to Canonical. It's important to us that there's no conflict of interest where it seems like Canonical's trying to control the platform and Canonical is exploiting developers to achieve their own ends. But it's also important to us that users have good experiences with this and aren't exposed to badly written applications or even intentionally written malicious applications. So just like there's a community process for what goes in the main, what goes in the universe, there'll be a community process to put a gate on these applications for that reason, those reasons.
And will there be a facility for developers to get revenue from that? Will there be a pay model, or is it still all free software?
Well, it's going to be it's for free and open source software, and there won't be any capabilities built into any, our platform or the Software Center to get paid, at least in this release, in Maverick. But you can use free and open source software if you want to get paid. You could just implement it yourself. So there's nothing to keep you from delivering software to your end users and say that they could buy something from you, content.
Extended packs or something.
Yeah, so that'll be, you know, that's fine. As long as it's free and open source software, you'll be able to get it through this channel.
Fantastic. Is there any other things at UDS? Is there any memories of UDS now that we're at the end of the week and we're just winding down? Is there anything memorable about this UDS, your takeaway?
It was really exciting having Evan here from Chromium and seeing the way that they build their software and seeing the passion that they have for Ubuntu. And I'm hopeful that we'll see the other companies like that, like, kind of join the Ubuntu community. And Evan and I were talking about maybe for the Chromium work that we need to do to make it run on UNE really well, maybe they could use our blueprints to track their status and stuff. And I just, you know, that kind of represented a real, like, highlight to me, sort of how diverse the community is getting and how we can embrace people with different goals and interests and coding styles and stuff.
Excellent. Thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
That's all for this time. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another clutch of interviews from UDS. In the meantime, you can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. And you can find our voicemail number, Twitter, Identica, Facebook, and the IRC channel, and all sorts of other things there.
And that's about it for this week.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.